Sears or in front of Verizon hubs or whatever you call them. You would call them depots where the trucks go out to fix things and so on. And also in front of hotels where the company, Verizon, this enormously profitable company, is housing scabs. Scabs, by the way, are workers that cross picket lines and work when there's a strike. It used to be a more general definition of any non-union worker sometimes was referred to as a scab, but that's a little too broad. I think people can't help it. Unfortunately, a lot of people can't help it if they're not in a union. But the general usual meaning of the word scab in a labor struggle means a worker that crosses the picket line, or anyone that crosses the picket line, to go in and try to help the company keep going. That includes managers. There's some managers crossing picket lines in the Verizon strike, say, oh, I can't help it. They're making me work. I have to work. And unfortunately, some union people sort of agree with that logic in some way. And it's wrong. No. If there's a strike, you choose your side. And hopefully it's not management side. It's not the bosses. It's not the corporate side. And you stay out. And then the corporate, you know, it's a risk, but it's necessary that the workers are risking. And if everyone works together, everyone gets their job back. I've experienced that myself. I went out on strike. People stopped working, and including people that weren't directly in the union. And we negotiated to get their jobs back after the strike was over. This was back when more strikes were being won, back in the 80s. So anyway, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class Democratic Socialist Perspective. We're here, as I said, every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. You're also listening to WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And that key two- or three-word phrase, WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford, is our legal identification. So we are all set to go. And thank you for listening, long-term listeners. We weren't here at our last show because it was a combination of Mother's Day and near my wedding anniversary, so there was no show. Over the summer, we hope to be here every other week without interruption. We'll see how that goes, and hopefully into the fall as well. So, and we've been on the air here for, I don't know, 10 years at least, and we are... Perhaps this is our 10-year anniversary. I lost track of when exactly we started, but I think it's our 10-year anniversary this year. And so for regular listeners to Socialist Alternative Radio, and also check us out on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio, welcome back. We do have listeners from around the country due to the wonders of the internets and the computer and live streaming and all that stuff. If you want to listen to our archive show, we only get one. The way it's set up here, they only archive one show for every 2 weeks, and then they only archive shows for 2 weeks going back 2 weeks. So for us, since we're alternating weeks, it's only one show. Go to WMFO.org, go to schedules, click on Socialist Alternative Radio. You'll hear the latest show they've archived. And also we have some of our shows archived on, which we really appreciate, by the way, Feedy and Rising. I'm not sure if that's purely a Facebook thing now or both Facebook and website, but go to feedianrising.org or go to feedianrising on Facebook. Feedian is spelled F-E-N-I-A-N. So as I said at the top of the hour, we are dedicating this show to the Verizon strikers. We will be talking about the Verizon strike. And also I'm looking out the window here at this show emanates from Tufts University, which is part of Medford's, it's on the borderline of Medford and Somerville, which in turn are bordering Boston, greater Boston. And the signal goes out around intermittently different areas of greater Boston, especially Somerville and parts of Somerville and Medford, parts of Cambridge, etc. But as I started to say a minute ago, we do have listeners from around the country on computer and also internationally. And we want to say thank you for the feedback on Facebook for our national and international listeners, and spread the word about the show. Our show is fairly unique in that we are 110% pro-union, 110% pro-socialist. We are openly proud socialist radio show people. And we don't dilute that at all. This isn't just about, alternative information, although that's part of the show. It's not just about giving you some sort of general liberal left viewpoint. We're not liberals here on this show, so we're not giving a liberal opinion. We're not giving a conservative opinion. We're giving an opinion you almost never hear on the airwaves, dominated, of course, by the corporate media. And that opinion, the viewpoint we're giving here is one of Marxism, one of socialism, one of democratic socialism, international socialism, revolutionary socialism. Different names fit the bill here on Socialist Alternative Radio. So enjoy the uniqueness of that, of hearing that. I'm not saying there's no other shows like that. There probably are. I think I ran into one time. But mostly if you hit any left shows on the radio dial, they're usually to the far left. If you're facing the radio dial, digitally, sort of lower numbers, and they're usually affiliated to college stations, because college stations, by law, by federal communications, blah blah, FCC, whatever that stands for, they say, hey, college radio stations, or they used to say more forcefully, you need to give some airtime to the community, because you're a nonprofit, et cetera, et cetera. So, so every once in a while, a left-wing show gets on the air through that law, and a real left-wing show, and that's great. And I'm not disparaging other shows that are less partisan than we are about socialism. I'm just saying it's fairly unique that you get a show like ours that is upfront pro-socialist, not only in terms of information, but in terms of we want you to become a socialist. We want you to join the socialist movement. We want you to join Socialist Alternative as part of the socialist movement. We want you to get involved. And if you want more information about getting involved with an actual socialist group, go to socialistalternative.org as a start. There's many socialist groups out there, but you might as well start with the one that's one of our dear sponsors here, Socialist Alternative itself, a socialist group, which I'm a member of. So go to socialistalternative.org for more information about what it would mean to get involved and join and so on. And Social Alternative as an organization is growing pretty rapidly. I think our growth accelerated with the election of Shama Sawant. That's K-S-H-A-M-A, first name, last name Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T. Shama is currently a sitting city councilor in Seattle, Washington. She just got reelected for a second term by a large margin. First term, she was a close race, but she was elected as an open socialist, as an open member of Socialist Alternative. That was in 2013 or 12 already. How quickly they forget, since I tried to help out as I could out here on the East Coast. And I think it was November 2012, and then she took office, I believe, in 2013. But I could be the other way around. Could be 2013. No, I'm pretty sure it was 2012 election, November 2013. Gaining office January. In any case, Shama Sawant getting elected got a lot of publicity, especially the first time around, because she was elected as an open socialist, open member of Socialist Alternative, to a major city council, Seattle, and on a great program that focused on, based as a sort of evolution of the program, based on an interaction between the people of Seattle and Shama's campaign, our campaign, which was the $50 minimum wage came to the fore. And then we turned that into a mass campaign. We helped get that passed in Seattle. So Seattle had the first citywide law for $50 minimum wage, brought in increments, unfortunately, but for some people it was immediate, and it continues to ratchet up to the $15 mark for most workers in Seattle. And that was came out of a struggle that started right next to Seattle in SeaTac that we supported. That got delayed by a court injunction. And so we went ahead in Seattle and initiated and helped win the $50 minimum wage law. And I'm talking about Socialist Alternative and Shama as part of that, a big part of that, a spokesperson for that, main spokesperson for that, really. Most visible politician supporting $50 minimum wage. And by the way, I was just in the library yesterday, and a public library, got a book called "15." I should have it with me. Why don't I have it with me? That's insane. $15 or something like that. And it's, I'll bring it in the next show. And it's written by an SEIU Service Employees International union leader who was also part of the struggle for $50 minimum wage. I glanced at the book quickly. I haven't read it yet. I just got it yesterday. And there was mention of Socialist Alternative, and the part I read was not bad mention at all, which is good. And I will you know, announce that book and urge you to get it next time when I have the exact title of the book and the author. It just came out fairly recently, and it's in the public library system, which is good. So anyway, as I think I mentioned, today's show's going to be a lot about the Verizon strikers, but we're also going to be starting off talking about a term I first saw in a Socialist Alternative publication, but I think it was out there before that, perhaps, and that's the precariat. Instead of it's a play on the word proletariat, which is a socialist word for worker, and instead of proletariat, it's the precariat, and it is it is a term being used in an ironic way for workers but an accurate way for workers that young workers, so-called millennials and so on, who have very little job security. They move from, quote, gig to gig, you know, replacing the word job with a sexier word, gig, and making that sound more acceptable, when really what it is getting hired as a term or a temp or whatever words the company uses for just hiring someone for a few months and then booting them out of the street, or working for companies that don't give enough hours. I was driving in, heard a thing on National Propaganda Radio about foreclosures, but in talking more deeply with a guy from Medford, actually, right here, was featured on the show. The whole thing started to unravel in his life and his family's life when his hours got cut at his job. So the precariousness of work now isn't just whether or not you have a job, and that's certainly precarious. Unemployment is much higher than we're led to believe, and it's hard to find work. If you do find work, the jobs that seem to be more plentiful, obviously, are the very low-paid service sector jobs. And then you have, even in those jobs, or jobs that are a little better paid, you have bosses that think nothing of just cutting your hours whenever they feel like it. That is just criminal, and it's a result of the whole collapse of sort of work rules, established work rules that unions used to establish usually they would start something that would establish work rules in contracts or in legislation that they pressured to get passed. And as unions get weaker in the United States, where we have no workers' party, no political party, acting on behalf of workers, and if you think the Democratic Party acts on behalf of workers, you haven't started to read the history yet of the Democratic Party. I don't blame you. There is a narrative, there is a fictional, mythological narrative that the Democratic Party is somehow more friendly to working people. Unfortunately, union leaders buy into that myth quite concretely with money. Our dues money, my dues money, has gone down the rabbit hole. And I could use other metaphors of the Democratic Party, and neoliberal policies have come back at us. Neoliberal being a fancy word for austerity, for cuts in social programs, for supporting laws that hurt working people, for supporting low wages, and the whole precarious nature of living for millions of people in the United States, the richest country in the world, and yet a country rife with inequality and unfairness and struggle that is unnecessary by working people, as our situation gets more precarious and weaker due to the weakening of the labor movement, due to the lack of a workers' party, a political party for working people. And part of what Socialist Alternative is trying to do is build that workers' party out of mass movements, out of electoral movements, and so on. And we'll get into that a little bit. I think I started this thought earlier, didn't finish it. I'm looking out the window, I'm seeing the graduation here to Tufts University. So if someone's sitting in a car somewhere waiting for someone to show up or whatever, they're listening to the show, congratulations to you and or your relatives for graduating from Tufts. It's been a bit of a struggle in itself, and good luck with everything. usually people give graduates some sort of advice or something, I guess. You know, that's the tradition through the speakers they have at graduations and so on. I remember at my college graduation, they had Dan Rather speaking, and a bunch of us turned our backs on him. You know, I mean, he was just a fool, basically, so I didn't really take his advice. But I also had a friend of mine, Corey Dolgan, was the speaker, you know, the smartest guy in the university, got the best grades, he gets picked to give the... I'm spacing on the word, the valedictorian speech. There you go. So he gives that speech. And it had been vetted, apparently, if I remember the story correctly. And Corey just used a non-vetted version and went after, this was at Boston University, 1983, went after John Silber, that scumbag. May he rest in hell. And he was a vicious right-winger who tormented the students there. And so Silber's up there on stage, and Corey launches into a whole thing against U.S. imperialism in Latin America, and it was just brilliant. You know, in Central America, that was a time of the liberation movements or attempted liberation movements, guerrilla movements in Latin America. And Corey just talked about the role that not only the U.S. was playing, but the role that Silber himself and BU was playing in perpetuating right-wing dictatorships down there and right-wing policies. And it was great. And of course, Silber scowled at him. Ooh, this guy Silber, if you've ever heard of him, John Silber, he was this, he was from Texas, wannabe intellectual. His work was a joke in philosophy. He comes up from Texas to Boston, brings that kind of, you know, that wave of Southern anti-unionism and neoliberalism up here. And he's and yet has the temerity to run. I mean, it fits in. He ran as a Democrat for governor. That's how some people have heard of him, if they didn't know he was at BU, running BU for so long, running it into the ground. Boston University was unique as a private university, affordable to the working class, until basically Silber came in. And then in the late 70s, I believe, or early 80s, and or late 70s, I think is more likely, because he was already there when I got there. And Silber proceeded to raise tuition every year relentlessly to get out the riffraff. I managed to squeak in as part of the riffraff, part of the last working class people there, except for those on full scholarship or whatever. I had a tiny bit of scholarship money and worked fortunately, and this is a thing, something the millennials won't understand too well, unfortunately, but I worked a union factory job in upstate New York from the time I was 17 years old, and any time I could work, basically. So if I had time off from school, I was there for vacations there in the summertime, etc. And it was, and I run into people now that think, like, or not so much right today, but like, say, go back a couple years ago, people that thought that $12 an hour was a high wage. You know, I started at $12 an hour at that job in 1978. So I'm working and saving, living at home, doing all that stuff, and managed to save enough for school, barely. Took out loans like everybody else. The loans were a pain, a real pain to pay off. Took me 13 years to pay off a relatively small amount of loans, because I never got well-paying jobs after I graduated. Blah de blah, you know, that was possible at the time I did it. It would be impossible today unless you got much more scholarship money than I was getting at that school. So it was very, you know, the working class at BU, you know, starting in the 70s, I mean, not starting, but in the 70s, working class kids could afford to go to this private university, Boston University. By the time I graduated in 83, that was off the cards, and it's still, I'm sure there are some working class kids at BU, but they are few and far between unless they're getting a lot of financial aid. It's one of these schools that pays that, if you look at, and Tufts I think is the same way, if you look at the actual tuition, it's really, really high. And again, that's what I mean by the struggle. I'm sure people struggled that were at the cusp of, oh, we make a lot of money, relatively speaking, but this is ridiculous, this tuition bill, and I'm just paying everything I can and taking out loans and, you know, people going into debt that otherwise would be making a decent living right now. I go, that's all, you know, precarious, but, and who knows what the future will bring. Obviously, under capitalism, much lower living standards, most likely in the near term. And but so the struggle ratchets up to the upper middle class, even, and it's there. It's huge. It's a big barrier right now. Education is actually in crisis in the United States. You won't hear it described that way, but it's actually a huge, huge crisis. There has been some talk in the corporate media about student debt, but it's sort of like muted, sort of underscored. And one reason that is that there's this idea that everyone goes to college in the United States, and they don't. They just don't. They can't afford it. And I was able to afford it through a bunch of circumstances that came together. Most people in my family didn't afford it, my extended family. And basically, there's just millions and millions of people out there. The majority of people don't go to college, actually, in the United States. Now, what happens is, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. You have a slim majority of people of college age going to college in the United States. And that is actually higher than other countries, a lot of other countries. What they don't tell you, though, is that this includes community college and all sorts of other, you know, for-profit stuff. And, you know, they just throw everything into the mix, label it college. And most of those people drop out. They just can't afford it. Or they got scammed or whatever. So, or both. So, when you whittle it down to how many people have graduated from college, especially if you, say, a four-year degree or whatever, all of a sudden it plummets. The percentage plummets to, like, I think it's around 25%, probably dropping a little bit. I'm not sure. I'll double-check that, but it's around 25% last time I checked. And that's pretty low. That's a quarter of all people that are, you know, able to, that are of college age, you know, and that's been pretty consistent statistic, although probably dropping recently. And on top of that, you have then how many people get master's degrees, how many people get PhDs. It gets really low. Like PhDs are like 2%, 4% of those eligible to try for that. And then you read statistics of PhDs being unemployed. A lot of people that get a PhD are tending to get a career in academia. Then they end up as adjunct professors. One thing happening in the labor movement now is there's a lot of organizing of adjunct professors. Adjunct just means you're being hired as a temp as a professor. It's a fancy word for, hey, faculty unions got so weak and so arrogant in some cases that they screwed themselves in a way. And, of course, there's the relentless corporatization of education. It's always been there. Sometimes it's faces more resistance than at other times. And so now it's a full-blown corporatization facing very little resistance, and therefore the explosion of part-time temp sort of professors at universities. And you hear the stories. You might have heard the stories. They're actually telling stories from professors that get paid so little or don't get enough class time that it results in low pay, that they're on food stamps or they are having to get other jobs that have nothing to do with teaching, et cetera. So anyway, the original point is you get these very, very low number of people actually getting access to higher education, like whether it's a four-year degree or master's degree or PhD, and the people even with those higher level degrees, even with a PhD, end up doing really jobs that have nothing to do with getting a PhD, that are very, very blue-collar jobs or whatever, and also jobs that are or jobs that are non-existent. They don't get jobs. They're working part-time or whatever, like everybody else. So that's just the precariousness of the U.S. economy, from bottom, desperately poor people that can't, that try to sell their labor, as use a Marxist phrase, try to sell their labor to the capitalists, and they are rejected for various reasons, up to the people that you'd think are perfect, just what the capitalists want. They did everything. They followed the rules, etc., and they're rejected because there might be in a field that there's no planning, real planning under capitalism. That's one of its horrible, horrible features. It's a very wasteful system, a very unpredictable system, a system that's not at all stable, although it might seem that way on the surface to some people if they're wealthy. It's actually a very unstable system and prone to crisis, prone to overproduction, overcapacity, as a Marxist analysis would show. And therefore, you can have that in a given industry. You know, you dutifully get your PhD in biotech, and then all of a sudden, the only places to get biotech are jobs are Boston and Seattle and Silicon Valley. Let's run over and get those play. Oh, wait a minute. It costs like $1 zillion to buy a house in any of those places, or $1 zillion to rent an apartment. And I can't get full-time work because there's so many people like me trying to, that dutifully got the biotech degree, and it's not expanding as fast as we thought it would, or whatever, you know? That stuff happens all the time under capitalism, all the time, from someone getting training as a welder to someone getting training as a scientist churning out the latest evil technology for greedy capitalists. And whether, you know, either way, if you don't hit it just right, like for example, another example is the oil boom that just happened out in the West. You're probably reading about that. Places in the West all of a sudden were boom towns a few years ago, because before the commodity prices, the oil prices started to fall. They were getting into shale oil and fracking and all that kind of stuff, creating more oil emanating from the United States than I've read than at any other time in history. And this was concentrated in certain places, of course, and this created boom towns. And here it is 3-4 years later, those boom towns are completely drying up, completely, because oil prices fell. The capitalists moved their investment, to put a nice word to it, to another more lucrative area. And so think of all the people in the energy sector, hundreds of thousands, that thought they were getting into a stable, well-paid environment for themselves and their families, and now they're out. Now they're desperately searching for them. This stuff happens all the time, even in boom periods under capitalism, and it's a real shame, real waste of human talent, real waste of natural resources in the case of the oil and so on. Anyway, so let's give a little more structure to the discussion here on the precarious nature of living. And you might have heard about this. Last show we talked about this, I believe. There's an article in the Atlantic Monthly that was getting a lot of press. Of a guy who used his own experience as he'd been on TV as a movie critic. He'd written a lot of movie critic stuff. He did a lot of journalism, and still he was one of these people that the way he got a hold of a statistic that was something like, I can't remember it, like 400 or, I'm going to conflate the two statistics, so I shouldn't do that. But anyway, basically he was saying, like the article I'm about to read from a little bit, he was saying that, well, if Americans are faced with X amount of debt, I think it was really low, or it was lower than what I'm going to read in this article, like $400 or something, or $600 or $1,000 or something, then turns out a high percentage, like 60% or something like that, or 49% or something, could meet that with cash, with savings. They would have to go deeper into debt, use a credit card, or not be able to pay whatever came up suddenly. And it was quite shocking, the statistics in that. And you should check that out for the Atlantic Monthly last, I think it's May, might have been April. Anyway, this is a similar article. The stats aren't quite as glaring, but they're still really horrible. It's called The Age of Precarious, a play on the Age of Aquarius. So that's quite funny, huh? 6 in 10 Americans living on the financial edge. Started out, I think it's an AP thing, perhaps. But this is the part I'm reading. The analysis I'm reading is from commondreams.org. Deirdre Fulton, staff writer, Common Dreams, wrote up this article. Just a few quotes from it. Quote, the picture is decidedly precarious, as two-thirds of Americans would have trouble immediately paying an unanticipated bill of $1,000. I think the Atlantic Monthly article had a lower figure for that. It was the same sort of argument, though. An unexpected medical bill or a dip in the stock market would be all it took to send two-thirds of Americans into financial distress, according to a new poll that finds lingering lack of confidence in the U.S. economy. Oh, by the way, just a quick digression, of which there are many on this show. I forgot to, if I had a word of advice for the Tufts graduates, because that's expected, I guess, of people sometimes, and I'm sure it's irritating. I don't remember anyone giving me any advice when I graduated. I guess they'd given up on me already as an English major. But the advice I would give graduating Tufts seniors today is not the usual, I think they're used to hearing, care about society, care about people and all that stuff. I realize a certain percentage of you could give a crap about other people, really, even if you think you do, that your actions speak louder than your words. But I would say there are a lot of empathetic, solidaristic Tufts graduates out there as well. And I would say to them, or the other ones as well, why not? Let's include everybody. Let's be magnanimous. As smart as you think you are, okay, I'm not going to say a cliche, as smart as you think there are, ever, there's always somebody smart. I'm not going to say that. I'm just going to say that one thing, I think anyone with their eyes open, college or not college, will realize is that there are many different types of intelligence out there. And whether or not people are able to act on that and develop that intelligence is a whole other question, very much related to capitalism and inequality and so on. But just know that there's a lot of people out there with different types of intelligence. And that's important in a lot of ways. If you have to interact with the lower classes, with the working class, and so on, or just figuring out what you want to do, and hopefully something that's not going to be hurting people too bad. Although that's really almost impossible under capitalism. Everyone's got blood on their hands to a certain extent, not in terms of culpability, but in terms of what you're forced to do to survive. But keep in mind that thing. There's a lot of different types of intelligence out there. It's really hammered home to me every day in talking to a wide range of people like I do through politics and through stuff like that. And and the conclusions that you can draw from that are innumerable. There are just so many. They come up every day. You know, assumptions you make about people. Wow, you really got to check those sometimes. I mean, they're useful. You know, everyone has to generalize and figure things out quickly. But you also should have a little bit of a question mark there, a little qualifier, that the person you just heard say something really stupid might be saying that for a whole bunch of reasons and circumstances and variables that are unusual at that moment, and that person might actually be pretty smart, actually, in other ways, or they don't know anything about that the thing they're talking about at that moment. I'm not saying that to let people off the hook at all. Like, you have to confront, especially people with power. It's good if you want to, right? If you have the courage to confront their errors, stupidities, mistakes, and so on, especially in an organized way. I'm not talking about like everyone sacrificed themselves individually or anything like that. But confronting, you know, the ignorance in this country, which is just phenomenal, you also, if you have your eyes open, you're going to run into a lot of intelligence, a lot of empathy. One of the main things about Marxism that maybe the professors don't focus on too much is that the only class in society internationally, including the only social class internationally, including in the U.S., that can really fundamentally change society and not to get too dramatic, but save humanity in terms of the crises we face based on capitalism, the climate change and so on, and the horrible inequality and the constant wars and so on. The only class that can really change things is the working class. And yet, in the way that people usually narrowly define that, or the cliches and mythologies about the working class propagated in a society where the capitalists rule everything, is the working class seems like the least powerful, the least talented, the least whatever. And yet, from a Marxist point of view, from a socialist point of view, who runs things? It's not the CEOs. They just make decisions, and then everyone else runs things, you know. And oftentimes not really based on their decisions, even though they think that's the case, or government programs and so on, whatever. People, working people run society in terms of the mental and physical work necessary to keep things running, to carry out the edicts, the law, the rules of the people that own, unfortunately, the tiny minority that owns the means of production right now. Owns the factories, the land, the workplaces, and so on, and in turn own the political system, or at least most of it. The way to organize against that and change that is a big topic of what tactics to use and all that. But the fundamental thing for socialists is the working class that's going to change society, not all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden a change of heart from Bill Gates or somebody. It's not going to happen, or Zuckerberg or whoever. It's a shame that the capitalist names that get most publicized are the ones that are perhaps not the not the ones running like Exxon or Mobil or whatever. You know, everyone has a benign view of Facebook, but you have to understand someone like Zuckerberg's going to have their investments in a lot of other places too. So anyway, but getting back to the main point, advice for graduates, a lot of different types of intelligence out there, and that's going to factor into your calculations, hopefully, if you believe that, in all sorts of ways, from you know, who you decide to hang out with, who you decide to partner up with, if you decide to, who you decide to look down on or not, and how you decide to not talk to people. And for the tiny, tiny, tiny minority of you that might want to do organizing, especially organizing for socialism, that becomes extremely important to be able to understand that one of the things that flows from the different types of intelligence that are out there is that working class people, including those that get degrees and so on, really have the power to change things. And the elites that don't have to work for a living, anyone that can say one day, hey, I don't want to work anymore and live a decent life. I'm not talking about people that are refused work and that have to scramble to survive. Those that can quit work and live off the labor of others, whether they're directing that labor or just living off it, that is those are not the people that are going to change society. The capitalist class, the 1% or less, they're not going to change things. Things are going well for them, actually, way too well, actually. So for the rest of us, we've got 66% of Americans describe their current financial situation as good, quote unquote, but the real picture is one of precariousness. And remember another thing from Marxism, consciousness lags behind reality. A lot of, since there's no workers' party of any sort, socialist party, communist party, labor party in this country, you have a real lack of historical memory. So instead of people saying at a mass scale, being able to talk to working people at a mass scale about the past betrayals of, say, the Democratic Party, past recessions and depressions in a real living way, and how things didn't work. You couldn't pull yourselves out of those by your bootstraps and all that kind of stuff. Rather that, it's like everything gets reinvented every generation. What happened here? Capitalist recession? Capitalist precariousness? And this, of course, has happened to many generations. The gold standard for the capitalists is the post-war upswing. They keep that's supposed to be normal capitalism, but if you study the history of capitalism in the United States and internationally, that's quite an anomaly. That's quite a different little period that's never going to be repeated again in the same way because of the confluence of variables of World War II and who got bombed out, who didn't, and where the United States was at that time and all that kind of stuff. I don't want to go into the whole history of the post-war upswing. We've done that in this show before, but the combination of a radicalized labor movement, even in the United States, coming before World War II, coming out of World War II, even more radicalized than one would believe based on standard histories in the United States, veterans coming back as part of that radicalized labor movement, basically not having the patience to wait around for a housing crisis to be solved, for employment crises to be solved, for retooling of the capitalists and the churning up that not just take that lying down. The burgeoning civil rights movement among the African American population and so on was all coming together, and that led to the capitalists in the 50s and 60s and other factors, the Soviet Union existing. It led to fights that got concessions. Mass movement in the late 60s or to early 70s stopped the Vietnam War, got more concessions from the capitalists. 74, 75 recession hits, and it all starts to go downhill. And not coincidentally, the movement, the weakness of the labor movement starts to accelerate. Already was showing some signs of weakness if you look closely in the mid to late 50s after McCarthyism. And other attacks in the 70s, especially deregulation under Carter, the Carter administration. I gotta love this guy Jimmy Carter going around, spouting out things that liberals then put around Facebook about, that sound very nice in some ways, but the reality is Carter was a vicious capitalist tool who really went after living standards in the U.S. with people like Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, and others. Because they had the liberal credentials, and they weren't going to be touched by the upper middle class core of the protesters that had happened in the late 60s, early 70s. And many of whom had been co-opted in the Democratic Party in the meantime. So by the late 70s, mid to late 70s, the Carter administration starts this huge wave of deregulation in trucking and utilities. Part of the Verizon strike stems from what the Democrats did to deregulate utilities in this country, including the phone company. Deregulating airlines, we're suffering from that to this day. Gee, I don't know, maybe airlines should not do baggage fees or something, as if that's going to solve every plane being stuffed to the gills, the seats not large enough, the price is horribly inflated, blah, blah, you know, yeah. No one writes about that except, I think there's something in The Nation about that. I haven't read it yet. I got it queued up to read, but I think there might be calling for more regulation of airlines, thank goodness. But before Carter and the other liberals got their hands on, did the 1-2 punch of deregulation and then Reagan coming in and continuing that, but adding an increased level of austerity and a tax on social welfare. So under Carter, you had the huge direct paid, by the way, deregulation caused a lot of union busting, really figures into why the union is so weak. Now, it's not PATCO. It's stuff that happened before PATCO, plus PATCO and Reagan and so on, that led to the weakness of the labor movement. But anyway, all that little brief history that I touched on points of, that is not going to be, the post-war upswing is not going to come back in the United States. Now, right now, you have, depending on what you read, profits that are matching or surpassing the post-war upswing level rate of profits for the big capitalists, but you don't have the movement that existed then, or the tail end of one leading into another, the civil rights movement and the black power movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement and so on. So, and it exists in the Soviet Union. So you have a lot of pressure off of big business to give concessions to survive, you know? I mean, 1968, if you look internationally, just as an example, that looked like a very revolutionary year for what was happening in France, a near revolution, to what was happening in even in the Stalinist countries, what was happening like Czechoslovakia in 68, what was happening in 68, 69, 69 in Mexico. So all sorts of movements that had recently thrown off British colonialism, French colonialism in Africa and so on. So the capitalists didn't feel very stable back then, and pressure brought to bear could get results that the same amount of pressure today brought to bear from a weakened labor movement and a weakened left cannot bring the same results. And the capitalists know that, and they are running wild over us, over working people. And that's the norm under capitalism, though. Prior to the post-war upswing, the late 1940s, the 30s, even into World War II, the 20s, oh my God, the 20s were vicious, anti-union. They said there was a boom. Oh, people, African-Americans weren't feeling any boom. Most workers weren't feeling any boom. If you tried to organize a union, you get shot in a lot of cases. The teens, even with the existence of a socialist party that was becoming a mass party, you still had vicious repression. The Palmer raids in 1917 and so on. You go back into U.S. history, the normal policies of capitalism are quite vicious. The inequality of capitalism is quite vicious. That's the norm. Post-war upswing was an anomaly. And now we're back in the sort of, in a general sense, the norm, back in the norm. There are differences, of course, in terms of level of industrialization and so on, but in terms of the general attitude and policies of the capitalists, they're trying to drive us deeper into wage slavery and debt servitude. And some people say, well, wait a minute, how does it help the capitalists to have workers making less money? They want workers to buy things, don't they? That doesn't that, well, that doesn't make sense. You're absolutely right. Good question. Doesn't make sense. Makes no sense at all. And even a capitalist that says that to themselves, if they don't go out and do the exact opposite of helping workers the next day, they're going to be gone. There's laws written into corporate governance in this country that demand you try to get the biggest amount of profit for the shareholders that you can. And to go against that anyway is cause for being taken off the corporate board and so on. There's probably even legal sanctions I'm unaware of that go along with that, or fines or something. And basically, So the idea of, we'll be less competitive tomorrow as a capitalist. We'll raise wages for all our workers tomorrow as a capitalist. I mean, you hear these stories about Costco or something, that they raise their wages at a certain point. Yeah, you know, I'll send that out on Facebook, too. I'll say, hey, yeah, the Costco managers feel like they can raise wages right now. That's great. Now, you dig a little deeper, there's pressure probably for that from a section of the workforce that is unionized, or it's not going to last. And what they give with one hand, they're going to take away with the other. Because the other Sam's Club and the other capitalist competitors out there, it's the nature of the system, whether monopolized or less monopolized, the nature of the system is vicious competition. Most effective way to make profits is to cut wages and have very low wage costs. And that's what the capitalists are always trying to do. And even the ones that say they're not, and the ones that really mean it, the tiny, tiny few that really mean that, they're going to be out of business soon, and they're not going to be running that company very soon. Everyone points to Ben and Jerry's. They were also the benevolent capitalists. Well, the reality of pay and so on was different than you think among the workers there. And also Ben and Jerry's, they no longer run Ben and Jerry's, basically. You know, they became figureheads a long time ago in that company. So you can give many, many examples. Back to the precariousness, the precariat that we're riffing off of here. There is evidence of optimism among the more affluent, quote-unquote, but two-thirds of Americans would have trouble immediately paying an unanticipated bill of $1,000. I know I would. I mean, I'm doing this show right now. This is not to get sympathy. This is just a reality that many people face in this country. I'm doing this show right now. I haven't eaten today. I've not had a thing to eat today. Now, part of that is I was rushing to get out, to get here early, because I knew it was Tufts graduation. I had to find parking, you know, and so on. So it's not totally like save money not eating, but part of it, a big part of it, is save money by not eating. Like, I've done this pledge recently. We're so in debt and so on. I've done this pledge where I'm like, okay, no outside food. Did you ever do that? I mean, I'm sure some of our listeners have done this, right? No outside food. And there's people, I know plenty of working people that never eat outside food. They're just so used to bringing their lunch to work and doing the chicken stew thing or whatever, beef stew thing every day, heat it up in the microwave, blah, blah, blah. You know, I hate that stuff, by the way. I have to admit, I'm a working class person with, like, tastes that go beyond my station. I don't know my place in this society, because if I had money, well, actually, I'd probably give a lot of it away. But if I had real money, I would, I'd go out to eat. I like restaurants. I like eating out. No doubt about it. My mother was like that too. My mother never went to college or anything. Had a very low paying job, and my father same deal. And yet, my mother insisted, I want to go out to eat sometimes, you know? And my father would go crazy. Oh, we're going to get deeper in debt. We did. We got deeper in debt. You know, it was crazy. And he would enjoy it. He would be like, oh, this, the whole time we'd be eating, he'd be grumbling about how much everything cost. And it kind of ruined things for me. But I got to admit, I inherited my mother's way of looking at that completely. She's passed on now, but, you know, I was really like, yeah, I like that. I like that eating out stuff. That is pretty cool. People bring you food. You eat it. It tastes better than the food at home, usually, blah, 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 you know. But then there have been times in my life where it's absolutely impossible for me to eat in a restaurant because I couldn't afford it. Even fast food is a drain, such a drag, fast food now, you know. I went into this place, where the heck was it? A takeout Indian place behind a store in Central Square in Cambridge. And I swear to goodness, like 2 weeks ago, the prices were around $7.95, $8.95 for a fairly good portion of whatever, you know, like biryani rice with chicken on top or something like that, some sort of kebab stuff, whatever. All of a sudden, everything's like $10.95. And I felt like screaming. I was like, do you realize you've cut me off of one of the few places I'd go to every once in a while to eat out for lunch? Because I'm not good. I don't have time to make my lunch and all that. The variety sucks all that. But now, lately I've been saying, no outside food. Again, I've gone through this before. I hate it, but I've done it. No outside food. Every piece of food that goes through my mouth, I'm going to cook or I'm going to prepare. And that's going to be it. And we're going to save some money, finally. Ha, ha, ha. Like everybody else. We're not saving anything, but we have the illusion we're saving money by doing that, right? So anyway, that's the rule now. So I'm like, no, I don't have time to stop on the way here. I can't even get an egg sandwich or something. No, that's not going to happen. No outside food. I'm going to drive all the way home. No outside food, you know? I hope I don't crash. I hope I don't pass out. Really, it's not that serious. Well, I mean, it might be if I, in a few hours, but right now I'm surviving. Anyway, but you know what I mean? This is the point. Like why are people, I work full time and my wife works full time. Why, you know what? We have a couple kids. It's one reason why, but anyway, people are making these choices that are just ridiculous to have to make in the level of commodity production out there, to go back to Marxism. There's so much stuff out there that everyone could be living in this planet a life of super abundance, and we could figure out ways to create a production that is like that or near to that in a sustainable way. We're not, you know, I think a good Marxist, a good socialist is not one of these people that's going around saying, oh, if the planet's going to survive, we have to, you know, do scarcity. No, we do sustainable production and recycling, but that requires planning. Capitalism is incapable of that planning. Capitalism is short-term exploitation of profit. Capitalism is the embodiment of every man for himself and God against all in economic terms, right? Sauve qui peut, as the French say. You know, that's save who can. That's capitalism in economic terms. And, I mean, in metaphorical terms. And that is really what it's all about. The idea of planning an entire economy, especially on an international scale, which is what's necessary, that is only in the realm of socialism. It's only possible under socialism, only possible under democratic socialism. And this is not guaranteed. Nobody that's a socialist now, and it is a growing movement, although still small, nobody's saying socialism is inevitable. I mean, there are, if you read Marx and other Marxist-influenced writers, one of the points, if you're reading about economics from a Marxist standpoint, socialist standpoint, a good socialist standpoint, you'll find that the argument, and it's true, that capitalism brings into being a lot of the things that are necessary for socialism. Hold on a second. We're going to get a call here. What number are they calling it on? Ah, there it is. WFO, you're on the air.
Hey, what's up, Jeff?
Diego, you can call me comrade. That's all right.
Oh, okay.
So I mentioned at the beginning of the show, right, Diego, yeah. What happened? You had a flat tire on your bike. You were a committed co-host.
I was in there, and then all of a sudden I just felt low, and I'm like, well, great. There goes my back tire.
Yo, is that because of the crappy infrastructure of capitalism or what?
Oh, yeah. And the construction is still on that street.
Yeah, I mean, I went through a period last year where...
It happened right by the bridge, up by the high school.
Yep. I went through a period last year where it was like every other week there was like a something in my tire giving me a flat tire. A nail. They kept saying a nail. I'm like, who's sticking nails in my tires, you know? And I don't think anyone was. I think it was just like, it was... Bad infrastructure.
Yeah, infrastructure.
So what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, I just I was looking at this. I went to on the 22nd of last month. I went to because of the asthma, and I'm not insured. And just to go in, so I can get a note saying that yes, he has asthma, so I don't get fired.
Right.
Now, right.
Right.
I'm looking at the bill, $725.
Who's going to pay?
They didn't do anything to me. All they said is, yeah, you got asthma. Here's your prescription.
Hey.
You need a note for work? $720.
Welcome to America, right? I mean, how many people would believe that?
Yeah, they didn't do anything to me.
You got to write this down.
I could have bought an inhaler. I could have, but because we're in a situation where the guy tells me, just bring a doctor's note next time you're in.
But yeah,
you know what that means. If you don't bring a doctor's note, well, you're bullshit, you know, BS.
So to get a doctor's note, it essentially costs $725, basically.
$725.
Right. Yep.
I'm not insured because of the situation I went through.
Yep. And that fits into what I'm talking about with the precarious nature of life here for working people.
Oh, yeah.
For those regular listeners, you might remember Diego. We talked about last show, I think it was, maybe the show before. I think it was last show. You lost your job and then went to, they fired you basically, and they shouldn't have. And then you went to, you got another job fairly quickly, but it's another kind of low paid, they screw with your hours type job.
Low pay, and also the hours are so, and about like, when I first started working, they would give me 4 days. And I said, this is only 32 hours. Oh, because we expect you to work beyond 8 hours. So if 4 times 10, that's 4, that's your 40. I said, okay. So I get 3 days off, but now they're adding more days, and I only get like this week. I only had this week. I literally only have Wednesday off, and that's it.
Wow, that's part of the Verizon strike. The strikers are striking against that kind of scheduling, weird scheduling that makes them work overtime without getting paid overtime, that makes them work 6 days a week so they don't get 2 days off. Yeah, it's nasty. It's really nasty. So how's that job going in general, though? Are you going to stick with it for a while? You probably have to.
I'll stick around for a while this summer. I'm thinking of heading. I want to get into Cambridge Naturals, which is the first job I should have, because everything's internet nowadays. What happened to the old school? Let me pick up the phone and call somebody.
Yeah.
So now you have to be attended to your computer like a cyborg.
Yep.
I've noticed on March 4th, but it was like a week and a half into it. Oh, I could have called a lady. I would have had an interview, and I would have been all set at $13.50 an hour.
Yeah.
Last I am stuck at an $11 an hour.
Yeah.
And they tell you after 80 hours, they say they give you 25 cents more.
Ooh, wow.
I said, I went beyond 24 hours. Oh, it's because we didn't check. You didn't train your one-on-one knife skills yet, and we have to check these boxes. There's all these little... Once you get in there, you start seeing the...
The fine print.
80 hours. It's this. No, you have to pass this to get this.
Well, I've had a few... I've had
obstacles in front of you, you know?
I've had like 3 or 4 union jobs, but I've also had some non-union jobs, and I remember like in one of my non-union jobs... They gave us an employee handbook, and the first page at the bottom, fine print, said, we can change anything we want in terms of company policies at any time.
Yep.
Why are you giving me this book with bullshit?
Subject to change, and ask to change this, this month, check out our new handbook.
It's
a new handbook.
Subject to change at any moment, at the whim of the bosses. Yeah, great. Thank you so much. Well, here it is, corporate America all over again. Yep. Are you going to try to get to Cuba this summer, or?
What happened?
Are you going to try to go to Cuba this summer or fall?
I can't.
Just can't afford it.
They don't have vacation. Oh, you talk about backwards. This place is backwards. They give you vacation, but they don't give you pay vacation.
Oh, my God.
As long as you want.
Oh, my God.
You can say, I'm leaving this month, I'll come back next month. Okay, but you're not going to pay for it. We're not giving you, at least Whole Foods, they had that.
Yeah, well...
Here, the only thing they have to give now is, because there's a law, is the sick days.
Well, I was thinking
of... Even that, they try to sneak out of
it. Yeah, I was thinking about Whole Paycheck and thinking about stuff that you talked about before they got rid of you illegally or rottenly. And it seemed like they were, from what you were telling me and from what I've read, they were doing a lot of layoffs, and they were kind of... they weren't hiring full time. Remember you said they were only hiring part time. So there was this trend that I would predict that whatever you experienced the Whole Paycheck, it might even be worse now in terms of benefits and stuff.
Old checks,
yeah,
at Whole Foods,
yeah.
But as far as what I had compared to what I'm now, it's like, forget it. It's just way better there than it was. As far as benefits.
Yeah, I know. Lesser evilism. Yeah, I know. When I go to Whole Paycheck, because I go there for certain organic stuff, I notice that all the portions are getting smaller, but the prices are getting higher. On everything.
They got they had a tear thing. They were cheating people with a tear. Well, the container weighs about half of a gram.
Yeah.
Or whatever. They were charging that in the price.
Yep.
Instead of tear, wear and tear, they call it a tear.
There's a new one in Arlington, a Whole Paycheck, right? And I went there and they had this sandwich, like Indian.
Non-sandwich?
Yeah, non-sandwich, right? So first of all, they gave me only half of what they were supposed to give me. And secondly, it was $6 instead of $5.99. The sign says just $5.99 each. So I'm thinking about that for a second, and I just took it back and got my money back. I said, that's the wrong price. Give me my money back. It's ridiculous. But why should I have to watch out for every freaking penny there, But you do, I stopped going there as much as I used to. I didn't go there that much.
Cambridge, you hear what happened in Cambridge?
No, what happened?
March 1st, 31st. I went to hold...
Oh, the fire?
I needed... No, they did a law where...
Oh, yeah, no bags. Bags, yeah.
Yes.
10 cents for a bag.
10 cents. I go and I go buy, and then they say, oh, it's 21 cents. I say, whoa.
Ah.
21 cents over, because I got food stamps. So I buy one food stamps.
Yep.
And I said, how is that 21 cents? There's no taxes on what I just bought here. Oh, no, it's the bags. March 31st. It's 10 cents a bag.
They don't tell you up front, man.
21 cents. So it's extra, they're getting a penny off of this deal.
No, it's 10 cents a bag, and they don't tell you up front. They go like the ones, like I went to Whole Paycheck the other day to get iced tea. Big mistake, right? But like they're like, would you like a bag? They don't say it's 10 cents for a bag. Because of this law in Cambridge, would you like a bag?
They're gonna push it, right?
So if I didn't know that, I'd just say sure and get 10 cents. And I might not even look at the thing and notice there was 10 more cents on it. But I look at that stuff because I have to. And, you know, I would notice that. So I don't do that. No, I'm walking around Cambridge now with a lot of stuff in my hands. Like I went to Walgreens and got some stuff right after that.